Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, The Ten Commandments, Terri Schiavo, and the pending battle over the next Supreme Court justice are just a few fronts in America's so-called culture war. At the heart of the debate, says my guest tonight, is where to draw the line between church and state. Legal scholar Noah Feldman says he has a solution that can work for everyone, but it's a high wire act. Tonight on Point, church, state, and a modest proposal to defuse America's culture war. But first, we begin tonight in Copenhagen, Denmark, where President Bush arrived this evening to meet with Danish Prime Minister Anders Fogh Rasmussen to thank him for sending several hundred troops to Iraq. Bush then heads to Gleneagles, Scotland, where the G8 summit begins tomorrow. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is chairing the group of the world's major industrial nations, and he's pushing for big international agreements on global warming and aid to Africa. Julie Mason is White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle and is traveling with the president. I asked her to describe the mood of White House staff heading into the summit.
They're a little trepidatious this year. Last year, as you know, the U.S. hosted the G8. This year, they're going into someone else's territory on someone else's agenda. Tony Blair has set climate change and aid to Africa as the key issues, and those are not at the top of Bush's agenda.
So how's he going to deal with this? Is the United States going to be the odd man out at this conference?
Well, they are, but no one's going to let that be seen. I predict they're going to come out with some tepid, sort of watered-down agreements on both issues, and everyone's going to declare it a tremendous victory.
Let's look at each of the issues. Climate change first. What does Tony Blair hope to come out of the G8 summit? What does President Bush intend to offer?
Tony Blair wants a serious commitment from all the eight industrialized nations to really cut down on greenhouse gases. He feels that global warming is a serious issue, a serious problem, and he wants an agreement in hand from all the countries. As you know, the U.S. is the only one of the eight which hasn't signed on to the Kyoto Treaty. President Bush says he doesn't know what causes climate change. He says we're studying it, but he's not fully convinced that it's man-made or caused by pollution.
But he has said just in the last day or two that a Kyoto-style agreement would have wrecked the U.S. economy, implication being he's not going to go there this time, but that seems to be something like what Tony Blair is pushing for. Is it possible that they could come out with a kind of split statement, one statement by seven and the other by the balance, the United States, the eighth?
That's not likely because the G8, they like to have consensus, and I think they would prefer to have consensus on a tepid agreement rather than have a split decision. Bush is never going to go along with Kyoto. Like you said, he feels that imposing new regulations on business to cut emissions would be hazardous to the economy, and he's just not going to go along with it. But at the same time, he's still a powerful leader. He still calls a lot of shots with the G8, and they're not going to let him hang out there by himself.
So what might he propose, and what might the other leaders accept as their tepid midpoint, as you describe it?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I could see them all the eight leaders signing on to an agreement that global warming is a big problem that needs further study, and that all industrialized nations should take it seriously, you know, which is something that falls far short of what Tony Blair is looking for, and the environmental groups and everything. But, you know, it sort of gets everyone on the record, and they can all come out and say they've done something.
Let's look at aid to Africa, then. Again, what would Tony Blair like to see happen? What is President Bush likely to propose or say?
Tony Blair wants to have a major impact on finally doing something about Africa, disease, poverty, famine, everything. He wants all the nations, all the rich nations, to step up. He wants to, in 10 years, he wants to double aid to Africa. At the end of 10 years, it would be $50 billion a year. Bush does not have that kind of money. The U.S. is spending so much on the war and other expenses, and further, he's not going to put a lot of U.S. dollars towards someone else's international agenda. If it was his idea, he'd be more likely to go along with it.
Do you have the sense, Julie, that the other members are likely to side with Blair on this one? Are they likely to commit to a doubling of their aid to Africa over the next decade while the United States does not?
Well, interestingly, all the G8 leaders are coming in this year severely hobbled at home politically. Putin in Russia doesn't have the clout he used to. Certainly Schroeder and Martin are sort of hanging by a thread. All these leaders, they don't really have the clout back home to do all that Tony Blair is looking for at the G8. So it'll be interesting to see how they split the difference, how they make it look as though they've done something significant, when really they're probably not going to be able to realistically.
As you describe it, that makes them sound somehow more amenable to George Bush's view of the world, given their own circumstances at home.
George Bush's view certainly does give cover to these other leaders who may not want to go as far as Tony Blair would like them to.
Ambitious agenda and maybe a less ambitious product out of this summit. We'll see. Julie, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
Julie Mason is White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with us from Denmark. New York University law professor Noah Feldman is no stranger to tough assignments. In 2003, the Bush administration sent him to Iraq to advise on the drafting of the interim Iraqi constitution. Now, Feldman has turned his attention to America's culture war and a seething national divide over the proper place of church and state that he says is the country's fundamental divide today. Now, Feldman offers a grand compromise that he says can work. This hour, On Point, church, state, and diffusing the culture war. You can join the conversation. Do we have a crisis here? Do we need a grand compromise between secularists and fundamentalists? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Aspen, Colorado, is Noah Feldman, professor at New York University Law School, where he specializes in the relationship between religion and political authority. In addition to a law degree, he holds a Ph.D. in Islamic Studies from Oxford. His article, The Church-State Solution, was this week's New York Times Magazine cover story. His new book, Divided by God, America's Church-State Problem and What We Should Do About It, comes out tomorrow. Noah Feldman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Feldman.
Noah Feldman, right off the bat, let me just ask you, you say there's a crisis here. Are you sure? What's the evidence? What's the crisis?
We don't have a crisis the way, say, Iraq has a crisis, in the sense that the government's about to collapse tomorrow. The crisis is that on most of the issues that are most important to Americans, and I'm ranging from symbolic issues like the Ten Commandments to issues like same-sex marriage, the question of when life ends, the question of stem cell research and when life begins, we've got a country that's pretty much split down the middle, and that makes it extremely difficult to make crucial decisions. My argument is that where this is coming from is a difference of opinion about the right relationship between government and religion, and if that is the question, that we can at least we can sort of move in the direction of having a debate about what matters.
You say it's so serious that it now threatens to destroy a common national vision. How do you see that potential destruction unfolding?
I think that each time there's an important and controversial question that emerges suddenly in front of the public eye, and it doesn't matter if it's Terri Schiavo or the Ten Commandments or the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruling that same-sex marriage is constitutionally required in the state, what we get is instead of having a debate about the issue, we just get a splitting into two major factions in the country with everyone yelling at everyone else, people making noises about how they can beat the other side. And after the last election, we had people musing about secession, and they didn't mean that literally, of course. I don't think we're going to have secession. But that's a sign that this is the kind of division that makes it hard for us to work towards common projects. And I think that's a very serious danger to the country in the long run.
And connect the dots for us here. How do you make the case that this boils down essentially to conflicting understandings of the separation of church and state?
On issue after issue, what you see is that the side of the country that, loosely speaking, is the Republican side, although I mean that only very loosely, is arguing that we need some common values that derive from traditional religion, and that if we looked to those values and this, if the government promoted those values, we could solve the hard problems that confront us and perhaps produce some unification.
Mm.
And on the other side, you have legal secularists who, again, broadly speaking, but only very broadly, correspond to the Democratic side of things, who are saying that what we need is to keep religion a wholly private matter, for religion to have very little to do with the way government makes its decisions. And I think this underlies most of these debates. I mean, just take stem cell research for one quick example. What you hear is not a debate about whether, in fact, the research that's currently being done on stem cells will lead to cloning. Instead, what we have is one side saying religion teaches that this is wrong, without very much inquiry into whether that's actually true, and the other side saying religion's got nothing to do with it, let's push forward. And that's not much of a substantive debate. That's a debate about whether religion should be the thing that makes up our mind for us.
You say your modest proposal, and we'll look at this in some detail, is that the separation of church and state be kind of revised, that instead of banning school prayer and the creche, the nativity scene on the courthouse House lawn, we flip it around and ban all government funding for religion, and in that, by allowing the symbols back into the public sphere, we defuse this standoff. Jack Beattie, what do you think of the crisis Noah Feldman identifies, and do you agree with where he finds the root of it, in this church-state division and differences over an understanding of where that wall ought to be?
Well, I'm always surprised when I see polls that show a broad consensus, even about controversial issues among the American public. Basically, people want some form of abortion rights. They're cool, generationally skewed toward homosexual rights. They do want stem cell research and so on. And this seems to be across the board. But elites, on the other hand, pose these things as Armageddon every day. And I'm afraid Professor Feldman is reading the elites for the people at large. It's in the interest of Reverend Wildman and Falwell and on the ACLU on the other side to make everything seem like, we can't get along, there are no compromises. And the very fact that our daily lives, so far as I know, we don't have religious conflicts popping up all over the country. You know, we used to have them. We used to have religious purges. We used to have religious persecutions, banning, shunning. Those things are all gone. I really do think that this crisis is what you might call robust pluralism, people debating fundamental matters as they should, and I don't see any great danger in it.
Jack, I hope you're right, but I'm just back from a big family reunion, and I've got to tell you, around the table there were some pretty tough subjects to address. We've got to take a short break here. Noah Feldman, please stand by. Noah Feldman's new book is Divided by God. We're talking tonight about church, state, and the American culture war. How it might be settled. Do we have a crisis here? Is the culture war threatening fundamental national unity? Or is this just healthy national pluralism? Is national unity at risk? Is it already lost? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about church, state, and the American culture war, about what can seem like a chasm today between secular and fundamentalist America, and how we might settle that culture war. Our guest tonight is Noah Feldman. He's author of the new book, Divided by God, America's Church State Problem and What We Should Do About It. You can join us. What do you think? Do we need a grand compromise between secularists and fundamentalists? Are you ready, like Noah Feldman, to bring back school prayer and nativity scenes on the courthouse lawn? Is it a good bargain to draw a new line at government funding instead of at symbolic religious expression? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Noah Feldman, you carefully label these two camps as values evangelicals and legal secularists. I wish you could define those for us, those two different approaches.
Values evangelicals, as I'm using the term, don't have to be evangelicals of a Christian faith, though they often are. They're just people who believe that in order for the government to succeed in producing some national unity, we should choose some values that we all agree on, preferably values derived from religion, and the government should then promote them or evangelize for those values. Values evangelicals think that we've got ourselves into trouble in this country by a kind of moral relativism, a kind of I'm okay, you're okay approach. And they believe that what we need to do is have a single right way of doing things and then stick with those values. On the other side, legal secularists might be personally secular. They might be people who don't particularly participate in religion, but they don't have to be. They're people who think that the government should be secular, the government should keep religion in the private sphere, and that the law, specifically the Constitution, should keep the government secular. And I think what's striking about these two different schools is that both of them want to be to live in an America where there is some unity. They both believe that we should have unity in the face of our religious diversity, but they're exactly opposed on how to get there. The evangelicals think that we'll never have unity unless we agree on something, and the secularists think that if we bring religion to the public sphere, the consequence will be that we'll never be able to agree on everything and anything, and we therefore should keep religion private.
You say that the fundamental goal of each of these camps is the same, reconciling national unity with religious diversity. Are you sure about that? Is that the number one goal of each of these camps?
One of the striking things to me about working on this subject and talking to lots of people and really both camps around the country is that each side tends to be very skeptical of the other. So I regularly hear secularists saying to me, well, of course, we want everyone to feel like they belong in American life, and that's why we're for keeping religion private. But the other side really just wants us to live in a Christian America. And evangelicals say, almost as a mirror image, well, of course, we want to produce common values, but the secularists just want to shut down religion and prove that it's all wrong. And I tend to take both sides at their word. I don't mean there aren't some cynical political players on both sides, but I think on the whole, most people who would describe themselves as fitting into one of these two camps really do believe that their way is the best way to produce an America where everyone can belong and where we can all feel like full citizens.
Now, you say that we need a new kind of understanding of this line between church and state, in part because the country can no longer accurately be described as Judeo-Christian or Christian, that there are many players here, which changes the old calculus. What do you mean?
Well, at each stage in American history, when we've had a new impetus for religious diversity increasing, when we've had, for example, Catholic immigration in the 1830s and 40s, or the birth of modern secularism with the spread of Darwinism in the 1870s and 80s, or Jewish immigration in the early part of the 20th century, we've had to come up with a new approach to church and state. So the phrase Judeo-Christian to describe our country is a good example of something that was really just invented in the 1950s by people who wanted to be inclusive. They had the idea that if they said we were a Judeo-Christian country, then perhaps we wouldn't seem like we were a country that was excluding Jews. Mm-hmm. But that terminology is not going to cut it anymore, because we now have Muslim Americans. So we could perhaps say we were a monotheistic country. Justice Scalia tried to say something a little bit like that, in his opinion, in the Ten Commandments case the other day.
Mm-hmm.
But that will not satisfy Hindus or Buddhists, or, of course, atheists, who also feel that it's very much their country. So I think these terms, even in sociological terms, are no longer accurate, and that means we need a new approach now that we've got newly increasing diversity.
You describe then, and I want to get to your solution here, because that's really where the rubber meets the road, but it grows out of a great change after World War II in the way religion was handled in the public sphere. Describe that for us, and then begin to take us in how you would, as I interpret it, sort of roll that back.
Well, the framers and those who followed them way back, 225 years ago, reached the consensus that the government should not fund religion, but that religious symbolism was not terribly troubling. And that was pretty much the way that things ran, with some hiccups, in American history until the 1950s and 60s. At that point, legal secularists, who basically got control of the courts, introduced a series of Supreme Court opinions that essentially required government action to be defined as secular. And that meant prayer out of the public schools. It meant that Christmas creches, as you mentioned before, were taken out of the schools, and sometimes it's taken to extremes, and you've got schools where people are even afraid to sing Christmas carols, and you've got people who think that it's impolite to say Merry Christmas to a stranger on the street, lest that person not be celebrating Christmas. And this really represented a sea change. I think it was well-motivated, because it was aimed at being inclusive of minorities, especially Jews, but I think it went too far, because it had the effect of alienating many people in the country who feel that some degree of religion, symbolically in public life, is a key part of validating their identity as Americans.
All right, so here comes your solution, and it is. Lay it on us.
The solution is, in a word, no coercion, so the government may not coerce anybody to perform any religious act, and no money. The government may not provide any funding for religious activity. But anything that doesn't fall into one of those two categories, if it's not coercive, if no one is being forced to say a prayer that he doesn't want to say, if no one is being forced, if no tax dollars are being spent on religious purposes, then it ought to be constitutional. So if you have a public pronouncement about religion, or you have a law passed by legislators who say openly that they're passing this law because their religious values tell them that's the way to go, that shouldn't be seen to violate the Constitution. That should be permitted. And that would give a lot more latitude to religious folks to speak openly in the public sphere about their motivation for the kinds of laws they want to see passed. And it would also allow some symbols, like the Ten Commandments symbols that the Supreme Court was ruling on last week, that would be, in a symbolic way, significant for values evangelicals who would like to see their religion displayed publicly.
So you're saying flip the formula that we have now. Now we have school vouchers, and we don't have school prayer or creches on the courthouse lawn. You're saying bring back school prayer, bring back the nativity scene outside the courthouse, bring on the Ten Commandments on the courthouse steps, but cut off funding for school vouchers, funding for faith-based initiatives.
This is really the arrangement that the framers knew and that worked very well for 150 years of American history. Now, in terms of school prayer, I would be very concerned about prayer that was actually coercive. So the state should not be forcing people to say prayers. And there will always be a delicate question of whether a six-year-old who's in a classroom where the teacher is saying, now it is time to pray, will be coerced, in effect, by the school or not. And, of course, we're going to have to work that out in practical terms. But if you're talking about high school students at a Friday night football game, which is a voluntary football game, I don't think that the presence of a prayer at that game is a fundamental violation of anybody's rights. It doesn't coerce anybody, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that to have prayer at a football game on a Friday night counts as a violation of the Constitution. I think those kinds of symbolic prohibitions really send the wrong message. They send the message to people who want to pray that they don't really matter in the polity, and they send the message symbolically that their values should be kept out of public discussion. I think that's very troubling. On the other hand, I'm very concerned about government funding through programs like school vouchers or charitable choice that directly supports religious teaching. That's traditionally been something that was wholly privatized in the United States so that churches and synagogues and so forth would have to find their own resources. And that's one of the reasons that religion has flourished in America, because precisely because it did have to rely on its own resources, whereas in Europe, where there was always government funding of religion, these days religion is in a dire situation, as anyone would be quick to acknowledge who spent time there.
And your interpretation is that if we let religion back into the public sphere, you won't have a situation where the religious, let's say majority in a particular community, are simply imposing their code. You're saying this is going to loosen up and in some ways lighten up the national conversation, not have it be so kind of paranoid and feeling persecuted. You say reason can in fact engage revelation. You say few evangelicals treat faith as a conversation stopper. You believe this would invite a healthier national conversation, not an imposition on non-believers or believers of a different religion, of a majority religion's view?
Let me be very clear, because there are 2 points here. One is that the Constitution squarely prohibits any coercion. So if you have a locale where people are trying to force kids to pray in school when they don't want to, that's squarely banned by the Constitution, and the courts need to step in and stop it. And I'm not saying that'll never happen. There probably are places in the country where it would happen if it weren't for the Constitution and it weren't for the courts. What I am saying, though, is that if we allowed much more public display of religion, that would encourage a debate in which we could actually talk substantively about why we believe, for example, that same-sex marriage is a good thing, and it would force evangelicals on the other side to explain in detail why they think that same-sex marriage is a bad thing, if indeed they do. That would make the debate, instead of making the debate about, well, my religion says so on one side, and the other side saying, well, your religion is irrelevant, we could actually have a debate about the merits, about the substance of these topics. And I don't think we would resolve all of them. We would have disagreements still, but we would be able to talk about the topics themselves instead of having what I think is really a sideshow conversation about whether it's fair to talk about religion at all in the process of the debate. When I say that religion is not a conversation stopper, what I mean is that if you ask an evangelical, you know, why do you believe, for example, that same-sex marriage is wrong, that person will probably say, I think that the biblical teaching on marriage prohibits it. But that's not the end of the conversation. One can still go on to say, well, why do you interpret the Bible that way? Or, I don't believe in that teaching of the Bible. What would you say to convince me that I should vote in that direction? And I think one would find that evangelicals will respond to these questions very actively. They're not going to say that the conversation is over at that juncture.
I wonder, Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just want to come in here. You know, at the time the Constitution was framed, 8 of the 13 former colonies had established religions. And Jefferson and Madison set about in Virginia changing that.
Established religions, meaning the formal religion of the colony.
Of the colony. And they set about changing that and then reflecting that belief in the Constitution. And Madison wrote, he's the author of the First Amendment, of the Establishment Clause, mm-hmm. and says Congress cannot establish a religion. He worried about letting even a little bit in. He said, it is proper to take alarm at the first experiment on our liberties. Who does not see that the same authority which can establish Christianity may establish with the same ease any particular sect of Christian, that the same authority which can force the citizens to contribute 3 pence only of his property may force him to conform to any other rule established. And in the case Engel v. Vitale, 1962, the great school prayer case, decided 6-1, Justice Black, speaking for the majority, wrote that the Establishment Clause, unlike the Free Exercise Clause, does not depend on any showing of direct government compulsion and is violated by the enactment of laws which establish an official religion, whether or not those laws operate directly to coerce non-observing individuals.
May I step in on that?
Noah, yes, please.
Noah speaking. Those are terrific quotes. I'm really grateful to Mr. Beattie for bringing them up, and I discussed both of them at length in Divided mm-hmm. by God. I think what you're seeing there is Justice Black in that very important school prayer case essentially rereading Madison in an extremely creative way. In Madison's conception, and he laid this out extensively in his writings, there was an obsessive concern about the government not spending even one nickel of its money to promote any form of religion, and that was what was at issue when In Virginia, for example, Madison and Jefferson were fighting to avoid the passage of a law that was intended to allow the government to fund religion through what was very close to a vouchers program in the way we'd recognize it today. Mm-hmm. But Madison had no significant trouble in his lifetime with religious symbols. And when he became president, he enacted, just as Washington had done, public pronouncements on questions of religion. And during his career, he also allowed and never opposed until the very end of his career when he was retired from public life, he never opposed government money being spent on chaplains. By the end of his life, he realized that was an inconsistent position, and he said that he, in his late writings, that he should never have done that in the first place. But essentially what you have in the 60s is that the Supreme Court took this traditional view that money was wrong and that coercion was wrong and said, just as Mr. Beattie quoted, that in fact coercion was not a required element of the Establishment Clause. And I'm suggesting that we should get back to the original understanding.
Coercion, but of course, what creates coercion? I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us tonight from Falls Church, Virginia, is Melissa Rogers. She's visiting professor of religion and public policy at Wake Forest University Divinity School. She was executive director of the Pew Forum on Religion and the Public Life. Melissa Rogers, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So Noah Feldman wants to flip around the way we look at the church-state divide today and say, cut off the money, no more vouchers, no more faith-based initiatives funded by Washington, but bring back the symbols, allow them back into the public sphere, into the government sphere, and we will open up the conversation in a fresh way, get out of this Gordian knot we're in. Do you agree?
Well, I respect Noah Feldman's work greatly, but I do disagree with him on some matters in his proposal, as I understand it. Let me first say that I'm a lifelong Baptist, but I don't feel like I belong in either of the camps that Professor Feldman laid out. I'm a religious person who believes religion has a strong role to play in public life, but I also believe that it is religion's job and not the government's to sponsor and promote religion, and that it's actually bad for religion and religious liberty when the government sponsors and promotes religion. But one of the things I think we need to clarify is what current law allows in terms of religion's ability to participate in public life. I don't believe that our current constitutional interpretation requires religion to be a wholly private matter. For example, in public schools, students can say grace over lunches and read their Bibles at school. They can form Bible clubs as long as their other non-curriculum clubs are being formed. Schools can teach about religion in an academic way, and the Supreme Court generally has embraced a pretty broad equal access policy, which essentially allows religious groups to express themselves on public property.
I mean, you may be happy with that, but an awful lot of religious groups have expressed unhappiness with the lack of more formal school prayer, time for prayer, with the lack of the nativity scene on the courthouse lawn. Even the Ten Commandments have been a huge flashpoint recently.
Well, and here's what I think. When we get out of those areas, which I was just beginning to talk about, but when we get out of those areas and talk about the government sponsoring or promoting religion, I think one of three things is going to happen that's going to be problematic. One is we could have the government declaring that this is a Christian nation or a Judeo-Christian nation, and I don't think that's what Professor Feldman is suggesting.
Clearly not.
At all. But that is obviously terribly divisive and problematic. Another situation could be that the government could attempt to allow all faiths an equal chance to be endorsed and promoted by the government. And I think this is problematic, and it's going to create even more divisions than we currently have.
Well, you're going to have Hindu and Buddhist and Jewish and Christian symbols on the courthouse lawn?
Yeah, and let me just cite, I grew up in the South, and I lived there for many years and now teach there. Auburn University did a poll in Alabama where they said that a 65% majority of people in Alabama said they would favor the display of Christian symbols in public schools and the government, but 50% opposed or strongly opposed the display of non-Christian displays in public settings. Indeed, only 28% said that they would mildly or strongly support non-Christian displays in public schools or the government.
So is that essentially coercion, whether or not it's intended that way?
Well, I think that it reveals a discomfort with robust religious expression from non-Christian traditions that we have to confront. And especially when we're talking about children in the public schools, but also beyond that in other settings. Then the third scenario, and I heard Professor Feldman talk about this a bit or read it in his proposal, that about a kind of non-denominational prayer that might happen. And I think, speaking from my tradition as a Baptist, We're taught to pray in a specific tradition to Jesus Christ, and it is very offensive in our tradition to be asked to water down that prayer, to take out sectarian references.
Mm-hmm.
And people in our tradition, for example, would regard some non-denominational prayer as not prayer at all, but more like a nice thought than a prayer. And I just feel very very much that this kind of non-denominational approach, while it would solve other problems, would not at all shut down the culture wars.
Melissa Rogers at Wake Forest, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. Noah Feldman with us tonight from Aspen, Colorado, author of the new book, Divided by God. Jack Beatty, stick with us. Of course, Noah Feldman says, if we don't find some way to create a sea change, we're going to have the national vision, the common national vision, destroyed. What do you think? If we give up school vouchers and bring back school prayer, who's won? Who's lost? What's won? What's lost? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about church, state, and the American culture war, what can seem like a chasm between secular and fundamentalist America. We're joined tonight from Wake Forest University by Melissa Rogers and from Aspen, Colorado by Noah Feldman. His new book is Divided by God, America's Church-State Problem and What We Should Do About It. You can join the conversation tonight. If we give up school vouchers and bring back school prayer, who's won? Who's lost? Is this a worthy compromise? Or a knocking down of the wall between church and state? What's your solution to the culture war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Tingsboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Steve Berthium, and I'm the director of the Atheists of Greater Lowell. And I want to thank Professor Feldman for his article. I did disagree with him on one point. He says that faith is not, it doesn't violate the rules of political discourse, but I think it violates the rules of polite discourse.
But, you know, faith was woven through so much of America's early political discourse, and yet it was quite visionary. Are they mutually contradictory?
I think they are, because when a person is appealing to faith to make their argument, it's a disengagement. They're saying, my argument cannot stand on its own merits.
But Noah Feldman writes, the skeptic can challenge the believer to explain how he derives his views from Scripture, why the view he ascribes to God is morally attractive.
Well, yeah, and it's up to the skeptic, though, to justify their position. The person of faith is not required to.
So you say, in fact, faith is a conversation stopper. Thanks for your call. Noah Feldman, what do you say to that? You know, that's the fear on one side of this coin.
I would say to Steve that when Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. made the argument from the Birmingham City Jail that the segregation laws, Jim Crow laws, were not just a violation of the Constitution, but were actually a violation of God's law, that he was not doing something that broke the rules of polite discourse. He was prepared to also make a non-religious argument for why he was right, but there was a kind of moral depth and power to what he was saying that I think was crucial to his argument and tremendously effective. And I don't think that it follows from someone using religion in discourse that they're being impolite, as Steve said, or that they're breaking the rules in some way. And I would urge Steve to do just what he's suggesting. Challenge people on the other side. If they act as though faith is a conversation stopper, let's not let it be a conversation stopper. Let's keep the conversation going.
Steve, does that sound like a workable plan to you? Have you tried it?
Yeah, I have tried it. And the religious person can always go back, look, that's just what I believe, that's what God tells me, and that's that. You're never going to change my mind.
There's the fear. Steve, thanks for your call. Noah Feldman, what about Melissa Rogers' critique here? She says, you know, lots of respect for your work, but she's afraid in the end this may not produce the result that you're hoping for, that you're promising.
Well, the admiration is mutual. If more people in the United States, or almost any people, in fact, had the nuanced combination of faith and legal sophistication that Melissa has, we wouldn't have this problem, and I wouldn't have needed to wade into the issue at all. I would just say, though, that in lots of cases, I think Melissa is not giving enough credit to what people are capable of doing when they look at things in a new perspective. So take a big debate that happened in Michigan in the town of Hamtramck last summer when the mosque wanted to broadcast the call to prayer 5 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And initially there was a lot of opposition. People like the people Melissa is talking about saying, well, it's one thing to have church bells, but we don't want to have the call to prayer. I mean, this is Islam. It's being broadcast into our homes. But after the argument was made repeatedly over the course of months that this was not really any different than church bells, people changed their minds. and there was a vote, and it was a narrow vote, but in the end, the town voted to not to pursue any kind of attempt to shut down the call to prayer. And I think that was a substantial accomplishment. I think you've got to give us a little bit of credit in terms of what we're capable of doing. On her point about watering down religion, I entirely agree with her, and I think that that's one reason that lots of evangelicals, if they really thought about what they really want in the public sphere, probably would not want to have these watered-down prayers. I think one reason that they're calling for these kinds of things is that they feel excluded from public discourse, and saying we should have prayers is just a way of saying that we our voices should count, too. I think these fights about, say, the Ten Commandments monuments, it's not that anyone is deeply committed to these monuments as a religious matter. It's that they are a stand-in for the sense that many evangelicals have that they're excluded from the discussion. Mm-hmm. What I'm basically saying is, if that's what's the message that they're communicating, let's just ease up a little bit and allow people to participate in the conversation, because that's what really matters.
Melissa, do you see evangelicals as excluded from the national conversation today?
Well, I wouldn't use the word excluded just across the board, but I think Noah raises a good point when he says that, you know, there are times in which people are, religious people are sometimes told, well, you can't, you know, you can't bring your religion into this conversation. And I think that's wrong. Religion has a role to play. It forms values and morals. And in our public policy debate and public discussions, people of faith should be welcome into those discussions, and many times are. Sometimes they aren't. And sometimes government officials in particular will misunderstand the fact that, for example, religious groups can use public property on the same groups, on the same basis as non-religious groups. But where I guess I would part ways with Noah is on saying that we need changes in constitutional interpretation to get there. I would think that if we can do a better job of explaining to people the opportunities for religious participation in public life that are very robust, that a kind of re-education effort would go a long way, I would hope and think, toward resolving any of these problems of exclusion.
You say that again, but there's been so much gnashing of teeth over so many years about that, it's hard to believe that people are really ready to accept what's there. Let's get a call. Jerry's calling from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just have a comment, which is, it seems to me that any public display of religion or religious symbol is meant to be persuasive, and it's not, I mean, the place for religion is in a church, is at home.
But you know, an awful lot of people in the church are told every Sunday, take your religion out into the world.
Yeah.
Well, if we are a nation that nurtures, you know, a number of religions, that's not really, that doesn't serve the country.
But what about the notion that for many people, their fundamental values are deeply tied to the religion? They want to bring it to the country as a source of moral strength, Jerry.
Let their actions bring the moral strength. I mean, praying before a football game isn't a moral stand.
It's a public statement. Jerry, we've got it. Jack Beatty, wait in here with us. I mean, Noah Feldman puts a lot of faith in the kind of conversation that emerges on the other side of this unleashing of religious symbolism into the public sphere, that people won't be so defensive and angry, and we can open it up to a deep discourse where, as he says, where reason can engage revelation. What do you say?
Well, let's talk about the child. Let's talk about the child in a school where the every day has to go in and like the children in New York State before that Supreme Court decision and listen to a prayer about Almighty God. And of course, he or she looks around the classroom, and what do they see? They see people pretty much of one religion. That's how it is in America. And pretty soon that child thinks something's wrong with her. Boy, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with her is nothing according to our Constitution. And to make that child suffer the kinds of social ostracism and self-doubt that any child who was brought up Jewish in the South can tell you ad nauseum,
Don't kid yourself. That would be revisited. We would have, just as the founders feared, at every election, the prayer would be changed. It would be Reverend Falwell setting the prayer for Virginia, and Reverend and Mr. Dobson setting it for Colorado, and somebody else setting it for someplace else, and they wouldn't just stop with the prayer. It will be a more elaborate prayer. We have a wall of separation. I entirely disagree with the professor who engaged in sophistical argument when he said, well, Madison, in his private life, he allowed symbolism and so on. Well, Madison also endorsed slavery.
Not his private life.
But he also endorsed slavery. The point is, he set up the great principle, which is that we should not have government establishing religion precisely because it acts to coerce the dissentient.
Noah Feldman, how about it? I read in your biography here that you grew up in a religious school, so you didn't attend that kind of public school setting. No doubt that gave you a great comfort with that kind of environment, but it also may not have exposed you to the kind of tacit coercion that can come along with religious symbolism in that kind of spheres. Is it possible that your own biography, you know, sort of separates you from the public school experience of most Americans?
I think that's a fair point. I went to the Maimonides School in Brookline, Massachusetts, actually, and whatever coercion there was wholly explicit. It wasn't tacit at all.
No questions about it, yeah.
But I think that, and I do think that I've gotten many reports from lots of people who did grow up in environments where they felt that they were the only kid of a particular faith who were made to feel uncomfortable by virtue of those prayers. And I'm not in any way disputing the validity of their experience. What I am, although I should add that I've gotten calls and emails from people on the other side of that experience too. What I would say, though, is that the fact that others have different beliefs than I have doesn't mean that I am less of a citizen than they are. And I think that's a hugely important message for anyone who's a religious minority. And here I think perhaps my experience helped me. You know, I knew growing up that I belonged to a religious minority as a Jew, and that fact didn't disturb me. I was comfortable with the fact that I was a minority. It didn't make me think that I was less of a citizen than someone who felt differently. And I think that's an important lesson as well. And if people are learning that lesson indirectly through the fact that people around them don't share their views, I don't think that's a fundamental constitutional problem. I do think that if a kid feels coerced by the school, that we're then in a range where I think we have to be very, very concerned indeed. But as long as it's not about coercion, as long as it's just about a feeling that one is different, I don't see that the Constitution protects my feelings or should be interpreted to do so.
Chris is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great
Hi.
Show tonight.
Good.
I consider myself an evangelical. In
Great.
Fact, I'm going to Duke Divinity School right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that I think the church is totally misguided in trying to win a culture war. I think that I actually agree with the earlier caller who said that it's not really a moral stand, and I don't think it is, to try to impose some sort of external thing on other people who happen to be citizens of the same country. I think that as a Christian, I think that Jesus calls us to love, and that if we will obey that command, then people will be a lot more interested in our faith than if it is legislated onto them.
What about the command to evangelize? You describe yourself as an evangelical.
I do, and I think that that should take place not in the court system, not in the legislative halls, but with our neighbors.
So what's going on with your fellow evangelicals who are clearly very eager to get this into the court system? I mean, we're in the throes of that.
Yeah, I think there's really a fear out there that is unwarranted, that somehow Christianity is under attack, that we're a persecuted minority, and I think that fear causes us to reach back to a history that's not really there.
What do you mean by that?
I think that, in large part, that the idea of America as a Christian nation is really bad theology, and it's questionable history from what I understand. I'm not an expert, but theologically, I think it's a bad claim to say that this nation is founded by God or on some kind of, you know, there's some kind of covenant with God. I think that, you know, America is a secular nation, and as Christians, our goal should be to evangelize, as you point out, but that takes place one-on-one, in our churches, in our homes, with our neighbors, not in the courts.
Chris, we've got the view, and we thank you very much for your call. Let's try and get another call in here, if I may. Tom is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Tom, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The reason I was calling is I've been concerned about the issue of school prayer for years. I'm 54.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts. I went to a public school. Saying prayers was always divisive just between Catholics and Protestants. let alone the two Jewish kids in the class.
Did you have you had prayer in your public school?
We had prayer in my public school, well, when I was a child, because
yep.
I'm 54.
Mm-hmm.
I used to ask my mother, well, why do we always say the Protestant version of the Our Father? Why do we never mm-hmm. say a Hail Mary?
Right.
It was always divisive. And I was so glad in 1962 when it stopped. And I would never bring it back again. It's not only divisive between believers and non-believers. I'm a devout Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I would never bring it back into public schools for that very reason.
But how do you bring the voice of religious America into the public discourse if that symbolism is excluded, Tom?
Well, because as a devout Catholic, I'm told to live my life as an example of living a Christ-like life. With, just as the previous caller, I don't think it should be. I think people should live their lives by their religion, and by their example, they should change the public discourse. I disagree with a lot of evangelicals, but the one thing I agree with Billy Graham about is that you have to change people's hearts, not through the laws, but through changing people's hearts.
No, we've got it. And Tom, thanks very much for your call. Noah Feldman, speak to the practicalities of your proposal for a moment here. Is there any chance of this actually happening, given the politics of this country, given the direction it's headed in right now? Do you see this kind of reversal of our current stance on church and state restriction?
I think there is a chance. And I think that chance is in part brought about by the circumstance of Justice O'Connor's retirement from the court. She was really the swing vote on a lot of these questions. And a new alignment will emerge on the court now with whoever the new justice is. And, of course, it's also possible we'll have another retirement, Justice Rehnquist.
And she kept alive the post-war restrictions on public religious expression.
Exactly,
in the government sector.
Yeah. The restrictions on funding. And so mm-hmm. in that respect, she differed from the others on the court. I should add, though, that I think Chris and Tom's calls are wonderful calls, and I'm very sympathetic to what both of them are saying. I think Tom is pointing to a very important historical fact, which is that these prayers were often divisive between Catholics and Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it should be up to local school boards to say, you know what, we can't agree on a prayer, or if we come up with a prayer, it'll be so watered down, as Melissa said earlier, that it won't even be one that is religiously meaningful, so let's not have one at all. I have no objection at all to that happening. What I'm saying is if you have a locale where the school board says, you know what, all things considered, we want to have some sort of a prayer that doesn't make kids feel coerced, I don't think the court should come in at that point and say that it's unconstitutional. So it's not that I'm actively out there saying we need prayer in the schools. I'm just saying that I don't think it should be something that the courts step in and prohibit.
Melissa Rogers, we've just got a minute left here. If it's not the kind of reversal, the permission of prayer back in the schools, of the nativity scene on the courthouse lawn, that Noah Feldman, that you would propose to sort of ratchet down these tensions, what do you propose? And beyond recognizing the freedoms that are already there, as you've mentioned, what else?
Well, I think that we have to do that. One of the things you forget sometimes is that leaders have sometimes told people that religion has been kicked out of public schools in the public square, which is not true. We need people to be better educated about these things because some people are telling them falsehoods about this. I also think the callers indicate an important theological understanding that it's not legal in nature. It's theological that says religious people should promote religion. It's not the job of government. And there's that tradition running through many faiths, and I think we need to recapture that tradition.
And Noah Feldman, finally to you, just half a minute here. Do you really think that the common national vision is hanging in the balance here? Are the stakes that large? Is a kind of civil war in different terms coming at us?
The true stakes aren't in the prayer in the schools or the Ten Commandments monument. The true stakes are in how we debate the questions of ultimate meaning. Who lives and who dies, when your life begins, when your life ends, who you can marry and who you can live intimately with. And when it comes to those issues, we will do a much better job of debating them if we can debate them in terms of their merits, instead of debating them over a secondary question of the role of religion and whether it should be allowed into the conversation. We should let religion in and then let the chips fall where they may.
You say open the door to religion and then have the conversation on the merits. There's the challenge. Noah Feldman, author of the new book, Divided by God, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa Rogers, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.